commutator, we get a minus sign there, and then it's the opposite for the electric charge, A dagger A, and then we get minus or plus D dagger B. But here, this turns out to be I del 3 T minus B. A, T, and A dagger 2, B, T, B dagger 2. But this turns out to be minus or plus. No, plus. This turns out to be plus or minus. So this one's anomalous too. We didn't work that one out, but I gave it as a problem. But I think that one worked out wrong. This one we said, well, you know, it doesn't matter whether we use a commutator or anti-commutator, we're still going to get this result, and you could see it from the calculation. But try the BB dagger one, because I think that one may work out funny. Have a funny sign. So all three of these are wrong for commutators. And right for anti-commutators. So, if we have the top sign, okay, so we're taking the anti-commutators here, then this one's right. You need BB dagger in order for B dagger to be the raising and B to be the lowering operator. So if this came out with the opposite sign, B dagger would be annihilating particles and B would be creating them. And that doesn't concern particles or anything. That would, you'd have a particle go into an interaction and just be annihilated. Or you'd have a pair of particles come in and both are annihilated and nothing's created. It wouldn't be good. For the energy, you expect... Okay, the antiparticles carry normal energy. We reinterpreted them. They're negative mass particles traveling backwards in time that carry the positive mass from past to future, from our past to our future. So in a space-time diagram, if I've got a particle that takes a negative mass from A to B, then As I move along through space-time myself and observe this, what I see is a negative mass arriving here means I see the mass of B decrease, and then later up here I see the mass of A increase. As it gives up a negative mass, its mass increases. So what I've seen is positive mass go from B to A. So minus mass going from A to B equals positive mass from B to A. And the same is true of charge, right? If I have a positive charge going from A to B, I see a negative charge. You know, I see the negative charge of B decrease and negative charge increase at A. So by changing the direction, the negative mass of the B state shows up as a positive energy, so I should have a plus sign here. But since it's the antiparticle, it should carry a negative electric charge. And all of that works just right if we use anti-commutators.
So we don't violate the positivity of mass in this argument?
We
don't violate the positivity of mass.
General relativity theory?
Right.
That's probably okay. Let's see, that's an interesting question though. You know, what happens if we're allowing... It'll be okay. The classical theorem for positivity of mass puts energy conditions. So you have some classical stress energy tensor. And what you require is, okay, for any time-like observer with four velocity u, this would be the observed four momentum, and you require that to be a time-like four vector. That's one of the energy conditions you can impose. And well, if you took this, right, that's my four vectors, I'm observing this thing, that if my four vector were in the negative time direction, I'd get a negative b here. You could impose the same thing as long as the negative mass here occurs for something that's going backwards in the light cone, you'll still get the same energy condition. Mm-hmm. On the classical set energy condition. So it's okay. Yeah. Surprise. That works. Other questions? Yeah, one. Oh, no. Sorry, I thought it was later. Any questions on the Durant theory? I think maybe we've covered what we need to for now about the Dirac quantization. So try E and M. Electromagnetic field. All right. So, want to do something else entirely? But this isn't too bad for E and M. But were there any questions under Act? We good there? So I would like you to try that DC dagger commutator. That's going to need to work through. And the questions on these, bearing in mind the different normalization, so you'll see stuff. You'll see a lot of omega, right? With Planck's constant being one. All right. Ep is h bar omega is the same as omega. So everywhere you see an omega in the online version, that's just the energy. So with that in mind, you might be able to follow the various normalizations, which is without much trouble. Oh, great. I could overrun that for us.
It will be two pictures, I think.
All right. So for E and M, what's the new thing that happens here? Well, the new thing is gauge invariance. All right. Let's look at... we got to think about what the fields and conjugate momentum are here. I think we looked at this a bit before, but the action is F(u)(u)(v)(u)(x). All right, that's fine. What do we vary? How do we get the field equation?
Vary F.
Vary F. Yeah, what happens if we vary F? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we get a half. The variation is F. F mu nu d for x. And since that F is arbitrary, we get F mu nu is zero. No field. Right. It's a solution, but it's not quite as general as we'd like. No, we don't vary F. All right, this doesn't look like a kinetic term for the fields, right? You know, like, what is this? This is just, well, let's see, what is F mu nu, F mu nu? Right, okay, two up indices. All right, we're taking the product of the trace for the spine, so we've got diagonal here, we've got minus E up there and E down there, and we've got B, Z minus BY, BX, minus BZ, BY, BX. And, all right, that's the one half, and then with the indices down, we have the same thing except the signs are inverted on the electric field. So what we're doing is taking corresponding elements and multiplying them together. You take, F00 here, F sub-00 there, multiply those together. Then you just work your way through the 16 components, multiplying the products of them and adding them all up. So what do we get? Well, F mu nu is then going to be, right, the product of corresponding energy components is just going to give minus E squared. We'll get the same thing here, so we'll get minus 2 times the electric field squared. Then the B's are the same.
We're using the minus 1. We're not using the Majorie's metric here, right?
It doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
It'll be the same either way. Okay, if I want to raise the indices here, let's use Majorie. So we have minus 1, minus 1, minus 1 times minus E, and, cross B kinds of stuff, times another one, 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. The B sector gets 2 minus signs, but the 0 I stuff gets 1 plus 1 and 1 minus 1. So regardless of whether you're using this or minus this, that's just an overall minus 1 squared, right? If I had minus 1, 1, 1, 1 here and here, the same result. So I get 2 minus signs on the spatial stuff, but on the 0 I stuff, I get 1 positive I, 1 positive 1, and 1 negative 1. So the E switches.
Joe's noticing that one of the BXs should be negative. You know, BX is a tangent.
That works. This is epsilon I J K B K. Right. So row 1, column 2 is B 3, and so on. All
right.
Easy way to know what the sign should be. And yeah, by doing it that way, you're doing something, you know, at least three-dimensional tensorial, and so it ends up making sense in terms of preserving handedness and stuff. It does the right thing when you do that. Okay, but then you're going to get twice B squared. So, you know, up to an overall factor, we're looking at E squared minus B squared. I mean, this is an interesting thing. This is a Lorentz invariant quantity that you can build from the electromagnetic field. There's one more. Who knows what it is? There are only two. Two Lorentz invariant quantities you can build from E and B. That's one.
Is it crusty? You know, it's not a little weird.
That's a tensor. It'll be a tensor, or a vector. This will be a scalar. To be invariant, it will need to be a scalar.
Oh, the plus. The product. The product like that.
That's right. Alright, but we need to prove it. Look at, alright, you guys know differential forms. Take the dual of F wedge dual F. That's Lorentz invariant. What is it? Alright, this is the dual of F mu nu dx mu dx nu wedge. Alright, then we need the dual of F. Okay, so we have an F alpha beta, epsilon alpha beta rho sigma dx rho wedge dx sigma, 1 over 2 here times 2 factorial for those guys. And then we want to dual of that thing. Alright, so we have 1/8, the dual of what? Well, F mu nu F alpha beta epsilon alpha beta rho sigma dx mu wedge dx nu wedge dx rho wedge dx sigma. And the dual of a fourth form, we just replace that with an epsilon, so we get F mu nu, an eighth F mu nu alpha, F alpha beta epsilon alpha beta rho sigma.
Isn't it mu nu or something? Alpha beta mu nu.
Where?
Which one? There's no forms, right? I mean, once you take the dual, is it zero form?
Yes, that's right. Epsilon, mu, nu, rho, sigma. So, all right. This is the wrong one. We want something, let's see. Well, we wanted only the one dual. Okay, this is giving us this one back. Right, this is how you write this, f squared. This is f wedge dual f. But let me raise an index. Let's finish. F, mu, nu, f, alpha, beta. F1, alpha, beta, rho, sigma. F1, mu, nu, rho, sigma. Right, this thing is up to a multiple. It's delta, mu, alpha, delta, mu, beta, minus delta, mu, beta, delta, mu, alpha. The multiple ought to be, let's see, if I get 4 times 4 is 16, minus 4 is 12, so I need a minus 2. So I have minus 1 quarter. Then, since these are anti-symmetric, I'm just going to get 2 times f unit squared. So that's the one we had before. So let's try another. So what we want is f wedge f. That's a 4 form, so let's take the dual of that. That's what we should have written. And that is 1 half f mu nu dx mu dx nu wedge 1 half f alpha beta dx alpha wedge dx beta. I want the dual of all of that. That's 1 fourth f mu nu f alpha beta. Then the dual of all of that stuff is epsilon mu nu alpha beta. There we go. So, what does that thing do? If I put an epsilon, let me take the tensor on the Maxwell field tensor. What happens? Isn't so hard. Let's call that f mu nu. Let's define that to be probably, let's take a half of epsilon mu nu alpha beta f alpha beta. What's that going to be? Well, f is going to be anti-symmetric. Let's look at the zero I component. That's going to be a half epsilon zero I. So alpha beta has to be spatial. That's going to be jk f jk. But this is the same as epsilon ijk fjk. And I just told you epsilon fjk is epsilon jk ldl. This combination is Kronecker kl. So I just get probably times 2. Yeah, times 2. So I just get the I. So the zero I components are magnetic fields. It's anti-symmetric, so I zero is minus that. So this curly F, the dual of the two forms F, mu nu, is we've got zero V up here, minus V down here. Well, guess what's going to be down this space. If we look at Fij, we get a half epsilon ij, and then we'd better have, let's say, a zero and a k, let's say, and then we'll have f zero k. Well, what was f zero k? Rho zero column k was electric field. So this is just E sub k. And if I move this over, this is a half epsilon zero I j k dk, which is a half epsilon I j k dk. Let's see, any factors of a half. Oh, okay. Plus epsilon I, J, K, 0, F, K, 0. That gives us a factor of 2. So we root the half. And so we just get an epsilon on E. So 0, E, V, minus E, Y, E, X, 0, 0, minus E, V, E, Y, minus E, F. So it just interchanges E and D. Give or take, it's fine. It might take E to B and D to minus E, something like that. This looks like it just takes... Oh, okay, so this is up, right? So what it's done, it takes... the star takes B and replaces it by E, but it takes E and replaces that by minus C. So it's this duality transformation. We actually talked about this duality thing. This is what it is. There's a symmetry in E and M. Back in E and M, under the transformation. Oh, I didn't get it. I didn't mark there.
How is epsilon 0 ijk equal to epsilon ijk?
Ij and k are still variable, but I fixed 0. Same as 0 is fixed, and now as I vary ij and k, that symbol varies the same way as epsilon ijk. Actually, you might wonder if there's supposed to be a minus sign there. Epsilon up is minus epsilon down, so I've not been completely careful with all my signs.
Okay.
I do think the transformation has one of these with a minus sign now. So you can look that out carefully. This was just given overall minus. This is minus everything I wrote down here, so there's probably one overall minus sign in everything. So let me break this up. Stick a minus sign in there. Epsilon up is minus epsilon down. So now, what's our invariant? This invariant, star of F wedge F, is a quarter of F mu nu, purely F. Right. So what we're doing is we're taking this thing, so this matrix, and summing term by term with that matrix. And so on the 0 I stuff, I get this B with that E. Then I get this minus B with that minus E. And then I get BZs with those Bs. I'm going to get E dot B here, E dot B here, two more E dot Bs there. I'm going to get four E dot Bs, so I get exactly... one conjecture, E dot B. That is the other Lorentz invariant quantity constructible from E and B. Those are the only ones. You could write functions of those. Any functions of those two, of course, is also invariant. But, those are the only two essential invariants. Now, what do they tell you about electromagnetic fields? It's sort of interesting. Suppose that the electromagnetic fields are the E and B fields of an electromagnetic wave. What do you know about the electric and magnetic fields in an electromagnetic wave? They're perpendicular, so E dot B is 0. How about the magnitude? Up to the factors of C, right, which we haven't put in. So both invariants vanish, right? E squared minus B squared with the factors of C, E dot B are both 0 for the electromagnetic wave. Well, that's true in every frame. So you boost and you look at that wave, and they're still perpendicular and equal, and you still get an electromagnetic wave, and it's still traveling on the velocity. Okay, so now suppose that E and B are perpendicular in some frame, but not necessarily the same magnitude. Well, they're perpendicular in every frame. Suppose that E is greater than B in some frame of reference. This has to be preserved, so in particular, it's always positive. It's positive in one frame because E squared is bigger than B squared. So E will be bigger than B in every Lorentz frame. And in fact, you can use that to show that if E is bigger than B in some frame, you can find some frame where B vanishes. Conversely, if this frame is negative, you can show that, right, if B is bigger than E in some frame, you can find some frame of reference where E vanishes. You have to look at the Lorentz transformations in detail to do that. You know, you get Finch and Koch stuff. And it's the usual kind of Lorentz transformation formulas you get for these components, only for a tensor, right? It's a rank 2 tensor, not a 4 vector. So you get two Lorentz transformation matrices, and you have to work out what that is. See chapters 11 and 12 of Jackson, but you can then show that those results hold for electric and magnetic fields. You can find a frame where one or the other vanishes, or whether both a frame where both invariants vanish. It's funny. If they have the same magnitude in one frame, they have the same magnitude in all frames. So, you know, a lot of neat conclusions very quickly once you recognize that you've got those. Anyway, look at our action here. What did we say? Fu nu is minus 2 times this thing, so we get minus 2 fourths E squared minus B squared. Varying E and B isn't going to give you anything interesting here. Right? There are no derivatives in the Maxwell action if you look at it as just a statement about the field. You know, it's the difference between the electric energy and the magnetic energy, whatever that means. You know, it's just don't know. But if we think of it in terms of the potential, then we've got a normal kinetic term here. This contains an A mu dot. This contains an A mu dot. So we've got, you know, A dot squared coming up, along with some other derivatives as A. That's fine. But we have the time derivative of the vector potential. And so it's the vector potential that we're going to think of as the field that we're quantizing. You know, this is why people get so funny about gauge invariance sometimes and, you know, Aharonov-Bohm stuff and want to claim that A mu is the photon and that, you know, it's got this physical effect. You know, it's not true. Any physical effect you measure still depends only on the field. But it's A mu that you quantize. You know, you talk about A mu, oh, A mu is the photon. So quanta of A mu, but the measurable properties of that field are still just the field, not the potential. The potential can't have a direct physical meaning because of the gauge invariance. So we haven't done the Hamiltonian formulation of this. Can we do that? Did we find the Hamiltonian for E and M?
We've done an action for that.
It's gloriously messy. Let's figure that. It's appalling.
Let's do it.
You got enough pictures?
Yeah.
Any questions on any of this?
Sure, we're going to find like the conjugate momenta and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we'll do all that. So we're going to quantize everything. I think we did one look at the conjugate momenta, and it's funny because of the gauge invariance. Doing the Hamiltonian formulation, we'll run into that. So our action is F mu squared, but we understand that F mu nu is D mu A nu minus D mu A nu, given that an overall sign. That ought to be sorted out in carefully writing it up, which you want this or minus this, I never know. you know, it's a convention. You just have to decide how you want to define, you know, which of these things you want to define to be F. But there's the usual convention. You want to do it so that E is minus d phi dt minus grad phi, minus a dot. I've got it exactly backwards. Minus grad phi minus a vector dot. So where this is a normal vector, and that's the up component where, so this is a zero up, and this is a I, and this is EI. So you would like to define the overall sign here so that you get this out. So that's the way to check whether you're using the sign convention you think you are. F0i is going to be, this is D0ai minus DIa0. So if we, it still determines, is this going to be,
it depends on the
metric. The up here or minus the up here.
Right.
So it's still. Fine. So that doesn't fix it even there. So never mind. That's not even try to sort it out. Let's just vary the thing. We'll get the right field equation either way because throwing a minus sign into these just doesn't do anything. The field equation, if we vary f and set it equal to zero, we're going to get 2 times f with the variation, d mu variation of a, which gives us 0 is f mu nu d mu of del a nu, where there are 2 terms like this because that's still anti-symmetric. There are 2 terms like this because we have 2 f, so we've gotten rid of the quarter. We integrate by parts, and we have d mu, f mu nu, del a nu, is zero. And so the field equation is the divergence of f equals zero. If we put in a source term, a j dot a term, we would pick up j on the right side. We're just dealing with the vacuum theory here. The Hamiltonian formulation we need the conjugate momentum phi mu should be the partial of the Lagrange density with respect to a mu dot. Well, let's see, what's that? The Lagrange density is, we've got a quarter here, then we've got partial with respect to a mu dot of f mu nu squared. And f mu nu squared has an f 0 I, f 0 I, and an f I 0, f I 0. Plus Fij. And these two are the same, so we get a factor of 2. So we have a half. This doesn't depend on a dot, right? A dot is inside this. This is, what did we say? Let's use what I wrote here. So this one is d0ai minus dia0. This one is going to be minus, d0ai minus dia0, which is going to be minus all of this. Let's see, what we really want is di up. So this is a time derivative of minus ai up, minus a gradient I of a zero. And this one is equal to a time derivative of AI up, because that is. And this one is going to be plus a gradient. That's the gradient operator of A0. Where? Yeah, because you get a sign in raising that I. The gradient is really DDX I. Or, how should we say that? Now, if you want it as a vector, that's probably actually that thing. This A dot occurs in this term and in that term. So if I look at these two terms, I want dB A U dot of, that's an AI dot minus grad A zero. And this one is minus AI dot minus the grad A zero. And then plus other stuff whose derivative with respect to A dot is zero. So I'm going to get two terms. These things should look like squares or something. I should get two of the same thing. Why are these signs backwards? That should have been on one. So there's no row minus. A factor of two cancels this, and then we just get the factor A I dot minus grad A zero, which is let's see, this thing was just D0AI minus DIA0. That's where we got it from. And that's just, zero on. Well, what's that? That's the electric field for I. We have electric field sub I, but the time component is zero. That's a little bit of a problem, because for mu equals zero, there is no A zero dot, right? So we don't get a momentum dual to A zero. What do we do? How can that be? What's the problem?
Masslessness of the photon, or no?
Actually, directly related to that. It's the gauge theorem, right, which imposes the masslessness. So the fact that our vector potential can be replaced by the gradient of anything, we're doing plus or minus field plot, means, I think we saw this before, that I can demand A0 tilde to be 0. That says A0 plus D0 phi has to be 0, which means I just have to choose phi to be minus the integral of the original A0 dt up to some time t. And then I get a gauge in which the time component of the vector potential is zero. Then this isn't such a problem, because I only have three A's. There's more gauge invariance, though, and you need to pay some attention to that. Eventually, I'm not sure it bothers at this point, but let's follow this through while we're talking about what gauge we can choose. As long as we're dealing with the vacuum field equation, we can use the gauge again.
What is the tilde?
Just a different gauge. Prime, just some other symbol. So it's the same vector potential, but a different gauge. So I can work with F tilde instead of F in all the field equations, and G of F tilde will be zero, just the same. Since F tilde is built out of the curl of A, it doesn't matter whether I use the curl of A tilde or the curl of A, I'm going to get the same field, because that gradient drops down. Curl of gradient is zero.
And I'm also, I'm sorry, the phi is now, is that a parameter or is that
that's an arbitrary function. Let's call it f. Any function. Right? I can change a by the gradient of any function at all, and I get the same field. Because the curl of this is the same as the curl of that, because the anti-symmetrization of those two partials gives zero. And so I can use that to simplify these fields. I can use it, in fact, to eliminate one of the fields. So, A sub I tilde is still some three general fields. It's still one too many. Because I have A tilde, the zero component is zero. I have A I tilde, arbitrary, in general some function of x and t. But now suppose I ask for the divergence of A tilde vector. That's some function. Don't know what that function is, but I can define a new gauge, let's call it A tilde tilde, to be A I tilde minus plus DI of some new function G, and A zero tilde tilde to be A zero tilde plus B zero of G. I still want that to be zero. So, in order to keep this one there, this one is already zero. So, I want G to be independent this time. Okay. But I can still change A tilde by the gradient of any function of position. You understand? Yes. Then, suppose I demand del dot A tilde tilde vector. That's equal to the divergence of A tilde plus the divergence of the gradient of G is the Laplacian of G. And I'm going to demand that be zero. Well, I know how to solve for a G that does that. The solution to that equation is G of, in general, x and t. So I have to be careful here, but it would be minus 1 over 4 pi times the integral of the divergence of A tilde over x minus x prime d cubed x prime. If I evaluate this at x prime, take the prime divergence, then del squared of this turns that 1 over x minus x prime into a Dirac delta function. And I can integrate and get the right answer. Now, those of you who haven't had graduate E&M probably won't recognize that solution. But it's the solution to the Poisson equation, right? What I have is I want to call del squared g is minus some function here. This is just some function h. We don't know what function it is, but if I can find a g that is time independent and solve that equation, then I can choose a gauge in which the divergence of the vector potential, the spatial part, is zero. Now, we have to worry a little bit about the time dependence here. If I take the g dt, that's equal to times 1 over 4 pi, you know, integral x minus x prime stuff. Then I have v0 of del dot a tilde, whatever that is, v cubed x prime. Let's look at what this thing is. V0 of the divergence of the vector potential let's use Maxwell's equations here. That I can interchange the order here so that the divergence of V0 of the vector potential, and that's equal to minus the divergence of minus V0 A. And remember, phi, you know, A0, we've already got to be 0. This is the tilde one. So, since this is 0, I can write this as minus grad minus V0 A tilde vector minus grad A0, because this thing is already 0. But that is just minus the divergence of the electric field. And since we're in vacuum, divergence of the electric field is 0. So the time derivative of that divergence is 0, and dgdt is 0. And so we haven't changed a tilde tilde 0 away from 0 by this gauge transformation. But we have now imposed a tilde tilde 0 is 0, and the divergence of a tilde tilde vector is 0. So two conditions on the field here. So what this means is, even though we've got a 4 vector, a mu, there are really only 2 degrees of freedom to this thing. Those are the 2 polarization states of the photon. Right? Those are the 2 degrees of freedom you get when you find a solution to the free field equation. Right? The solutions to the free field equations are waves. Right? Waves are transverse. They are, the E and B fields are always orthogonal to the direction of propagation. That's what that divergence equation is going to mean. If we have a wave solution, this means that the wave vector dotted into the vector potential is 0. That's telling us that the wave is transverse. We're going to do a Fourier series for this in class, but we'll see this in detail in a Fourier transform. Okay. You hanging with me? It's a little bit of a flaw. You got one? Okay. Is it in there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. Can I answer a question? Gauge invariance. A back vector. Do you understand the gauge invariance?
I think I'm fine through here. And
we introduced it. Think of it for Newton's gravitational law.
Okay.
All right. The force is minus the gradient of the gravitational potential.
Mm-hmm.
I can change that potential by a constant, and it doesn't change the force.
Sure.
That's a gauge for you.
Okay.
It's just one constant. It's not very interesting in that case. Here, I can define a potential for the electromagnetic field, but that potential is a 4 vector. And I get the electromagnetic field by taking the curl of that 4 vector.
Okay.
There's some freedom in that choice of A. This is the freedom. I can change it by the gradient of F. If I put the gradient of F in here, the curl of the gradient of F is 0. So here, let me just write it for you. If I take d mu a nu tilde minus d mu a mu tilde, that's what I should mean by x tilde mu. but that d mu of a nu plus d nu d nu of f minus d nu of a nu minus d nu of d nu of f. Mixed partials commute. Those two are the same, so those drop down. And I find that I've got the same as f nu. So the electric and magnetic fields are the same, even though I've changed my choice of the potential. So here I've just got a lot more choices for that potential than I do with Newton. And I can use that to simplify the field. So I can use it to impose these two conditions for free field, the electromagnetic field. Let's suppose from here on in our discussion of quantizing the electromagnetic field that we're going to work in a gauge where these hold. Now, the absence of a pi zero is no problem because we don't have an a zero either. So we've got three a's, we've got three pi's, we've got some constraints on those remaining a's, some differential constraints, but we'll deal with that later. Okay, so got pictures all around? Let me start back over here. Go ahead, Joe. You
half effect.
Sure. So now we let's see. What can we do? We can write the Lagrange density in terms of the field. These time conventions are a nightmare with this stuff. figuring out, going back and forth between the usual vector notation and indices up and indices down and. Sort of horrific. We'll just try and get it right. So, we've got, I want to drop the tildes. So, now we have A0 is 0, we have the divergence of 3 vector A is 0. We don't need to keep writing two tildes on everything for the rest of the calculation, that would just be tedious. So, our action, 1/4 integral f mu nu, f mu nu, e4 x. Is equal to 1/4, then let's go ahead and rank this thing out. We have d0ai minus dia0 with d0ai minus dia0. And then we have the same thing with those indices flipped, so I'll just call it twice that. And then we have diaj minus djai, diaj minus djai. But now I and j are still being summed from 1 to 3, so we don't need the factor of 2. We already have it. We have a sum on I equals 1, 2, 3 and j equals 1, 2, 3, so we're summing over everything already. And if we can figure out which way the signs go down, that's all d4x. We can write this as 1/4. And let's see, this. We can drop the a0. Those are zero because we made it so. Here we have a time derivative of AI. Here we have, this would be minus the time derivative of AI. So we have A vector dot J squared in these two terms right here, and two of those. Then over here, let's see, this is going to be, well, now, this looks like a curl. That should be, how do I raise one index? I'm thinking this is minus the curl of vector A. And then here, let's see, that's what I get if I raise both indices on that, so it should be the same thing. So this should be the curl of A squared, or 2 minus sine, something like that. We can probably work some miraculous identity on that to make it something decided out of two curls.
Is there a minus sign missing from the first term? Or am I? Because when we move the up?
Yeah. Right, because, yeah, this I up gives us a minus. This one's already up. I can move that zero down with no sign. So, yeah, there's exactly a minus sign. Good. Right. So, that's our field equation. Let's see if we can reduce that a little bit. What does that look like? If I have the curl of A dot the curl of A, that's just epsilon ijk djak. Oh boy. Where are the indices on this? All right, we want this to be a vector. Epsilon I of J K DJ of A K ought to be a curl of A. Conjugate momentum, now we only expect the pi I, should be the partial of the Lagrange density with respect to A I dot. And so now we see that is just, looks like we get a minus sign, but it's just A I dot. A I dot, up or down. This is both up, so it's A I minus A I. So I can write it as minus or plus A sub I dot, if that makes more sense to it. We'll just see what works. So then the Hamiltonian density ought to be pi I A I dot minus L. So we get I dot. So this is minus pi I is A sub I dot is minus a I vector of point vector dot. This is that same thing, vector dot. Then we subtract L, so we're going to add a half a vector dot squared. Okay, that worked. And then we have to subtract a quarter curl of A. That's the magnetic field squared. Okay, so this is good. So it's negative definite. We probably want it positive definite, but let's not quibble about an overall sign. A dot squared minus a quarter curl. And then this is in terms of pi, that ought to be pi squared as well, minus a half pi vector squared. So if I raise this, I get up. I get a minus sign, up I get a pi I up, so pi vector is minus a I dot. And if I square that, the minus sign goes away. Let's write that as a vector. And so there's no change in that sign. And then I get the magnetic field squared. Let's see. This is epsilon ijk bk with epsilon ijk b or l bl. Those two epsilons together give me twice delta k l bk bl. So that term looks like it's minus 2 times b squared. I'm a little worried I've lost a factor of 2 here. Yeah, because this is... So, yeah, when I go to these vectors, I ought to have a minus 2. So that's minus a half. Sorry about that. This becomes plus a half. Plus a half. Plus a half. Yeah, I'm really suspicious of the overall sign. We certainly like H to be, you know, looking positive definite. So, I don't see where the sign went, though. Let's see, so this has a minus sign in it. Well, I think we can feel confident here that we've found half the sign errors. this bears a story. Let's see what happens if we try and compute the field equations there. That may cast some light on what the right equations are. So the Hamiltonian should be the integral of the Hamiltonian density d3x. And Hamilton's equation. Ooh. Are you guys ready for this? Mm-hmm. How do we differentiate this with respect to either A or I'm not too far. I guess it doesn't really work between Hamilton's equations for a field theory quite. Yeah, we didn't write Hamilton's equations.
We never did that, no.
There's a function of derivatives, right? A is a functional of A here. And so, you know, instead of taking the partial of H, right, so normally defined P dot, we would take minus the partial of H with respect to the X's, and define X dot, we take the partial of H with respect to the P. But H is a functional of the field A and the momentum I. And so what we get is AI dot is going to be the functional derivative of H with respect to pi I. And pi I dot is minus the functional derivative of H with respect to AI. It's a straightforward generalization. It's just that this H is a mapping from some entire field, right? So a function to the real. So it is a functional, not a function. The way to correctly differentiate a functional is functional differentiation. We probably carefully defined that like a year or so ago, maybe. Have we been through that? I don't remember whether we talked about functional derivatives or not. It's what you're doing when you vary an action, but since you're setting the functional derivative to zero, you can get away with, you know, talking about it a variety of ways. If you actually want to take a functional derivative of something and have it be a functional, then there's a little more formal definition that works. Here, we can just vary this thing, and then whatever the variation inside is, the coefficient of the variation is the functional derivative. So we can use an intuitive approach here without running into problems. So let's see what happens.
So here we really don't have two independent equations. A dot I is negative pi I. So we only really...
No, that's a pi I dot here.
But isn't one just the second derivative of the other one?
Well, it is, yeah. But what that equals is, okay. Right, that's going to be the field equation. We hope. Okay, so the Hamiltonian, where the Hamiltonian is of this sign, pi I squared plus a half curl of A. And we might as well see. That is the easy one. And this is d4x. Or no, sorry, d3x. Integral of a Hamiltonian density. Now, notice this is pi of y. This is going to give us a dot of y. What happens when we come inside, okay, this doesn't depend on pi, so we're just going to get minus 1/2, then we'll get 2 times pi times the functional derivative of pi of x with respect to pi. That's J I of y. Right? This is going to be 0 unless x equals y and I equals j. So this is a conical I j times a delta function, x minus y. D3x. So the 2's cancel, that's nice. And we end up with minus pi, the I is up, so this becomes a pi up of y. So what we get is pi I of y is equal to minus a I dot of y. And that's not bad. That's what we had before. So far so good. The clients are checking, although backwards. We could have defined the gap to be minus this. That's a matter of convention, and we just go back and sort out what overall time we want. But let's see what happens now if we take, if we want to find pi dot, pi sub I dot. That's now the functional derivative with respect to a I of y of all of this stuff minus pi squared over 2, which won't do anything. But then we have all of this stuff. We've got 1 half, and let's see, how can we write this? Epsilon I j k d j a k is one curl, and another curl is epsilon I has to be summed L M B L A M. Since it's square, the overall sign doesn't matter, so lowering the K and lowering the M didn't make a difference. So I think we're okay with that. And we still suspect that the overall sign here could be wrong. But and then we can sort out those in terms of some Kronecker's. But if we take the functional derivative here, we're going to get 2 factors of the same thing. It'll cancel a half. And then we'll have epsilon I j k, let's say d j a k, then epsilon I l m, d sub l of the functional derivative of a m of x now with respect to a I of y. And now I want to raise that m and lower this m. I should be able to do that for free. So let's put that m down, that m up. So it's a minus 1 on each one. And now this is a Kronecker im times the Dirac delta of x minus y. So I get pi I dot is epsilon ijk djak times partial l, epsilon I down l of m down partial l of I get Kronecker im and del 3 of x minus y vector d3x. Now, how do you handle a derivative here of a delta function? What do you do?
Change the variables.
What do you say?
Change the variables.
Sorry.
Change of variables.
Think of it like a variation. What do you do when you've got the derivative of the variation?
Integrate
by parts.
Oh, okay.
Integrate by parts. The derivative of a delta function, delta functions only exist under integral signs anyway. So derivatives of delta functions are defined by, put them under the integral sign. Now you integrate by parts and you get the derivatives on whatever you're integrating. So you get a free delta function, then you can integrate.
Can you say that again?
Sure. Let me give a quick example. Here, what we want to do is integrate by parts. So I'm going to write this as write all of this as partial L of everything minus partial L of that stuff. And then the surface term presumably goes away. And now I have the free delta function, and I can just integrate it normally. In general, if you have the derivative of a delta function, it's going to be under an integral sign, you know, times some other function. You integrate by parts, so you end up with the derivative of that function. Then you integrate over the delta function, and what you get is the derivative of the function evaluated at the new point. So this has got to be, all right, I throw out the surface term. I assume things vanish at infinity or whatever we need to. So I can write this as minus integral partial L of all of the rest of this stuff, epsilon I, j, k, b, j, a, k, epsilon, why is this I? Hang on. That's I. Oh, sorry. I used an I two ways here. This I had better be, let's call it N. So that's this one that's some. That's N here and N there. We have a free I here. So this one is N, and this one is N. This is I. Okay, that's it. So then N, L, the M just becomes an I. So we have minus the derivative on all this stuff times L3 of X minus Y D3X. Now we can do the integral over X, and it's just an ordinary delta function. So what we get is this stuff as a function of Y. This is all dependent on X. All we have to do then is sort out the epsilon. We have epsilon I, J, K, epsilon N, L up, I down, D, L, D, J, A, K of Y, after we do the integral over the delta function. And let's see, N should have been summed about this one. That's N. So now what we got here is this sum. Let's see what that is. If I let me lower this L and raise that L. Then this becomes delta J L delta K I minus delta J I delta K L. And let's see, if I took the full trace, here I should get 6. Here I get 3 times 3 is 9 minus 3 is 6. So that's the full answer. So that's equal to this, partial L partial J A K. So delta JL gives, that minus becomes plus of a quantum because that D is up, and normally we want them both down. So it's a quotient of AI for the first term, then plus delta IJ, so this becomes a gradient. We have plus that, this becomes a derivative K up, so what I want is the gradient sub I of KL gives me, that's the ordinary divergence of A. The divergence of A, we happily chose to gauge for that zero. So what we get is pi I dot equals del squared of AI. Well, pi I dot We know what pi I is. It's minus AI, but up or down? Let's see. Plus AI down. Dot. But now we take the dot of that, so it's double dot. Minus del squared AI equals zero. That's the D'Alembertian of the field zero. And that's the right field equation. Bingo. So, lots of new topics here. Functional derivatives of things and all that. Maybe you guys, you know, want to talk about that sometime? We can talk about functional derivatives a bit. I didn't quite realize that we'd be jumping into that. This is how the Hamiltonian formulation works for a field theory. This is all classical field theory here. No one ever does this until you do quantum field theory. Nobody knows about it, but you know, this is really what it consists of if you handle it. Look at that, we've got three field equations. What do you know? That's pretty amazing. Yes, one.
So we can't define any raising and lowering operators with just this action, right?
Yeah, we can't work right in the field. There are no derivatives
of the field
in that action. So, you know, you don't have any motion. You know, nothing moves until you... All right, there is one way you could do it. Okay, if you don't assume this comes from a potential, you could put in a Lagrange multiplier that... tells you that, oh boy, I mean, how would you do this sensorially? You know, what you want is, you want the homogeneous equation. And, you know, the homogeneous equations look like this, right? Now, how can we write that? You could take something like epsilon mu nu alpha beta f nu alpha comma beta, make a vector out of it. And take four Lagrange multipliers. So add something like that. So then multipliers lands with you. So this constraint that does involve derivatives of the field, and it's this constraint that tells you that f comes from a potential. So varying lambda, you get the homogeneous equations, that lets you write E and B as derivatives, and then you can use this condition together with whatever lambda gives you to write the field equations. Try. You'll get that to work. So you can do it with fields if you use Lagrange multipliers. This, remember, only gives the versions of F. That's only half the equation. So when you write this action for Maxwell theory, you're assuming it comes from a potential. You've already decided that. F is the curl of a vector. And if you want to get around that, you need that. No reason not to put that in. I don't know what lambda mu ends up being or meaning. That'd be a good exercise. You know, that's not hard to work out. We can do it if you want. Depends what you guys want to see. What do you want to see? Well, this is kind of cool. That's actually just like worked out that. Neat. Who expected that? All right. You see some functional derivatives in action in a simple way. This is the way you can use functional derivatives. You can take second functional derivatives. You can build a functional Taylor series for a functional. You know, when you produce quantum corrections, in a sense, you're really doing that. Okay, the path integral is a functional integral. You're integrating, you know, over all field configurations, e to the I over h bar times the action. The action is a functional of the field, and you're somehow integrating over all field configurations. That's a functional integral. You know, the inverse of functional differentiation. So if you were to expand e to the I action as a functional Taylor series, and compute term by term, you know, what you would be doing is probably the finite perturbation theory. You would come out doing just what you thought you were doing. These higher functional derivatives are the first functional derivative is the classical field equation. Right? You set that to zero and you got your zeroth order field equation. That's the extremum of the action when the first functional derivative vanishes. Looking at higher derivatives, you're looking at things that happen away from that classical path, or that classical field configuration. And that depends on those higher functional derivatives. Should we quantify it or look more at you want a formal definition of functional derivatives? What do you guys want to see?
Third quantum.
Okay. Good. Here we go. So what do we do? Quantize it? You got a picture?
Oh, yeah.
So A vector as our field, the conjugate momentum phi vector is minus a dot. Okay, so we impose canonical commutation relations to the px or xp.
XP.
Okay. So, AI with, let's say, pi j. And so, this means that pi sub j is equal to A sub j dot. Then we're going to get I h bar 1. If this is A of x, and this is pi of y equal times, then we get del 3 of x minus y, and now we quantize stuff. What do we need next? We need the solution to the field equation. Well, here's our field equation. We better solve that. How do you solve the wave equation? Wave. So, we take the solution, and now, let's see, we should be a little careful here. Let's, we've got box A equals zero. That's our field equation. We write a Fourier series for AI, and what are we going to get? We're going to let AI be some epsilon I times e to the I k dot x minus omega t. And when we take box of that, it has to be zero. That's got to be epsilon I. That's just some constant vector, that's epsilon. I don't know what that is yet. That's just some fantasy vector. We'll get to that. But, all right, we have a four-dimensional k dot x. Let's see, what's our spine? Let's call that a minus four-dimensional k dot x. Time.
That's one. Don't worry about that.
E to the minus four-dimensional k dot x, that's better. And then it's going to pull down a minus k vector squared and 2 minus I omega. But that one becomes plus, then minus omega squared. It has to be 0. So omega squared is just
squared.
That's our constraint. So AI of x and t can be written as the integral d4x over 2 pi to the 4th times epsilon I e to the minus I on that I 4-dimensional k dot x plus epsilon I dagger. Is this thing complex? Or it takes a complex conjugate of this thing, bar.
Some of you
bar star. Some of you using for a complex conjugate.
Dagger.
We can say dagger. That's fine. Let's call it dagger. Then e to the I k dot x. And then we have a delta of omega squared. Delta of omega squared minus k squared. That gives us the solution. So, let's see, does that give us two terms, or do we... Yeah, we probably need the complex conjugate, don't we? We could get a sum of two terms.
Can we get two terms from the delta function?
Yeah, right, that's what I'm thinking. So this ought to be analogous. So we get a positive and negative frequency thing. We need some normalization. Let me just see what he uses for normalization. Because remember, the coefficients are functions of k anyway. Yeah, 2 omega p. So we're going to get the usual thing. After we integrate over the delta function, we have ai of x and t here. And now we'll just use... he still calls it d3t. T is h bar k, so t equals k. E is h bar omega, so e equals omega. So we can call this d3t. And he uses the same normalization as before, root 2, I think he has an omega here though. Yeah. Go figure.
So that integral on the bottom line over there, is that supposed to be with either p or k? D4. Is D4x.
Oh, yeah. D4k. So k equals t, omega equals t. Right. It's just the mass is zero. The only thing here is to remember is h bar is 1 and the mass is 0. So now we have some vector, we have some amplitude. Dependent on t, e to the minus I. Is he doing t dot x? Yeah, he's just doing t dot x. Fine. This depends on t in general. Then we have a dependent on t, e to the minus I, k dot x. Plus epsilon I. AP dagger, E to the I, theta, E to the P. Stick with the book's notation, so T dot X here. Now, we have to sort out, this is the conjugate. We need that epsilon to be the conjugate, so the thing is real. But we have more than one solution here. And we need to know what these epsilons are. So we can tell what these epsilons are.
Polarization.
Yeah, these are the polarizations. And we know there are only two, not three. And the two follow from a constraint, our gauge constraint. So this is the choice we're allowed to make, but we did choose del dot A equals zero. What's del dot A? Well, del dot A is equal to D3P over 2 pi cubed root 2 omega. Then we have, right, it's going to pull down, we have minus item AT plus IK dot X, or P dot X. So it's going to pull down an IP. And we get IP vector dot this epsilon thing. AT is minus IP dot X plus, but then we get the conjugate, so minus, it's going to pull down minus IP, dot epsilon conjugate, EP, ECI, P dot X. And this is zero, so P dot epsilon is zero. Well, P is the direction of propagation of the electromagnetic wave, and what that says is epsilon is any direction orthogonal to the direction of the three momentum. So this is right for waves. That's the direction of the pointing vector, for example. Right, the pointing vector goes in the direction of the momentum. Right, E cross B, E and B are perpendicular to the direction of propagation of the wave. And so is the vector potential. We only need the vector potential to be non-zero in direction perpendicular to the direction of the wave. But in order to get a general solution, we need to sum over possible polarization. So we can let epsilon be an epsilon. All right, the polarization can depend on the momentum. It also depends on lambda equal 1 or 2. We need two vectors perpendicular to the momentum. So as lambda runs over 1 and 2, E of lambda equal 1 is one vector perpendicular to P. When lambda equals 2, it's a vector in the P cross epsilon 1 direction. Right? Perpendicular to that. So in general, if this is the direction of the momentum, then E of P and lambda equals 1 that way, and in some mutual, how do I make three perpendicular vectors here, epsilon P 2 is that way. And for a general wave, we can have any amplitude in each of two independent directions. So we need a sum over lambda.
Were the A's that we have there?
Yeah.
Were they there before we did the time or the frequency integral? Or did they come about from
the... No, those are the amplitudes. So a plane mode, a plane wave, I can have any amplitude I want here.
Yeah.
Right, that's just some constant.
Yeah.
At a given P. But that can change, when I take a superposition over different P's, I can change that amplitude in a P-dependent way.
Okay, so I'm just... The spot, the integral on the bottom line,
mm-hmm.
Should there be an A in there?
Oh,
integral
I see, yeah.
Okay.
A. Yeah, here it depends on K and omega, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right, so far, those are independent times, very much.
And then...
You're using up all your film. This is so great.
The epsilons are still three vectors. They just only have 2 degrees.
There are only two of them.
Okay.
Yeah. And for any P, they're orthogonal, both orthogonal to that P. Okay. We can take them to the unit vectors because the amplitude is in that A. So.
Okay.
So, finally, we have AI of x and t is integral d3t 2 pi cubed root twice omega sum lambda equals 1 to 2 over the two polarization states epsilon I of t and lambda a sub t e to the minus I t dot x plus the complex conjugate use complex polarization vectors. So, for example, if it's circularly polarized, we take, you know, I hat plus square root of minus 1 J hat, and that will give you a circularly polarized wave. As long as the total potential itself, you add the conjugate over here, and it'll be fine. So it ends up being real. So you can get an electromagnetic wave whose electric field vector oscillates around like that. That would be a circularly polarized wave. And then the orthogonal one oscillates the other direction. There's still linear combinations of I and J and hat. I had J hat, or, you know, if it's moving in the K direction. So those are all possible. So here's our solution. This is the final thing. I think we've got it right here. We've used Maggiore's normalization here. That could be anything, because we have arbitrary functions of p in here anyway. But we've chosen that normalization so that, of course, the commutator a and a dagger is something like 1. Okay, so pi. What's pi? Minus a dot. Let's see. If we lower the index, we get the minus sign, if we can remember that. So I could write just pi I, that was x and t. Do the same thing here, d3t, 2 pi cubed, root 2 omega, sum over polarization, then F1 sub I, that contains the minus sign, depends on T and lambda. A T, but we're going to pull down, let's see, minus I omega T, so it'd be plus, so we have an I K that comes out of this. I
omega.
Sorry. So minus I omega.
Minus.
And then here we get a minus, right? Now we impose canonical computation relations. Should we keep going?
Some have to be leaving soon.
Yeah, I didn't have any plans for the next week. You guys going to be here Monday? You're not out of town or anything? Okay. Yeah, I'm here Monday. So, good.
I'm going to need to bail pretty soon here, too.
Okay. Do the rest of the problem. Right? We have... the canonical commutation relation, AI with pi j, you know, of what x and y, we said is I Kronecker ij times del 3 of x minus y. So here's the program, and, you know, it probably does everybody more good if you guys go do this than if I stand here and do it. But we solve
right.
Or
epsilon.
A, a B, and A dagger.
Oh, right.
Right. And compute their commutator. And, okay, you solve this by, what do you have to do? You're going to take dot with one of the other polarization vector here, and take an inverse Fourier transform. So dotting with the polarization vector is going to, you know, pluck out one of these directions, one of the other directions, so you can dot with each of them. And then you'll get some combination of Fourier transform, free up the A, and you'll get an A of minus P or something, as some integral over pi, but then some combination of the Fourier transforms of these guys will give you A, and the conjugate A dagger. Then you compute this commutator, that's equal to some double integral, let's see, there's an X integral somewhere, right? P depends on the y, d3y integral of that thing. So you probably think, is that where we get a d3x? No, d3x we get someplace.
We do, we're trying to plug out the stuff, yeah.
When we do the Fourier transform.
Right.
Yeah, okay, so we've got a D3X and a D3Y here. Oh, and let's see, is that all we need for those two? Okay, D3X, D3Y. Oh, but then we get E to the I, DX and E to the I, QY. Have integrals over all x and all y.
We're going to have, at some point, we'll have two integrals over q and then over
right,
p,
q, okay. Right, then over
we're taking a commutator here, so it's going to give us a commutator of a and pi. That gives a conjugate of x minus y. So we do the y integral, all the y's here become x's, and now we have an integral d3x over e to the I p minus q stuff dot x. That gives us the double function in momentum space. So, just write that down. It'll turn into a kind of bigger B. We'll get the delta function in the product of two things that look like this, and you can do all the integrals to get a delta function. Good. I'll stay and answer questions if anyone likes it.